Ronnie Sander at the 9th Annual Northern New England Tradeswoman Conference. Okay, I'm just starting at the beginning.
Okay.
What motivated you to be a trailblazer in non-traditional work in the beginning? How did you learn carpentry?
Well, I guess there's a couple things. One, and I tell this story all the time, when I was in junior high, I wanted to take shop. Mm-hmm. And I'm old enough so that when I went to my guidance counselor, I was told girls don't take shop, girls take home ec. And I said, but I don't want to take home ec, I want to take shop. And he was like, well, actually it was a she, it was a guidance counselor, and she said, well, girls don't take shop, girls take home ec. And I was so insistent that they sent me to the assistant principal, who, and you know you're in trouble, right, when they send you to the assistant principal. And I went through the same thing, and the assistant principal, after many back and forth, finally said to me, you will take home ec. So I think that I was, my mother always says I did things just to rebel, and I think that I was partially rebelling against that. The other thing was that I always liked working with my hands. I always liked doing stuff with my hands. But like most of the women who are my age, I went to college, and I had choices of being a teacher or a nurse or a secretary, but I went to college, so, you know, that was not a choice. And then I graduated from college with 200,000 unemployed teachers, because all of a sudden they didn't need teachers anymore, because we'd all listened to them. So here I was, living in northern New England, trying to figure out, what am I going to do? And I actually, the first job I ever got in the trades was working on highway construction. And it was back in the days where there was no such thing as a flagger, but it was laborers. You were hired as a laborer, and then, you know, different people flagged or did different things. And I got that job through total persistence of, you know, the superintendent would say, come back in 2 weeks, and I'd be back in 2 weeks. Come back next week, and I'd be back. And I think they finally hired me to get rid of me. And I worked two summers as, you know, I didn't think of it as being a trailblazer, but, you know, I was a tomboy growing up. It was like, I tried all these other things. And I worked two summers as on highway construction in northern New Hampshire, and I had a good friend. This was back in hippie days. I had a good friend who was a master carpenter, and he had just gotten a fairly large renovation job on a fire-damaged house in Franconia, New Hampshire. And it was right at the end of the summer, and I was about to get laid off from highway construction. And I said to him, you know, if you need other people, I would be very interested in working with you. Actually, let me back up a second. About 2 years before that, I had taken an adult education course on carpentry, on how to build your own house, because I had bought land in Vermont and I was going to build my own house. And so I thought, oh, before I build my house, I should learn something about it. So I took this adult ed course. I was, of course, the only woman. I never completed it because it was 40 miles from where I lived and it was the middle of the winter, so I only got to about half the classes. But I learned terms and I learned jargon and I learned tools. And this friend of mine was very impressed that I knew, at least to some extent, what he was talking about. I still didn't understand why 2x6s on the ground were 2x6s, but when you put them upright in the wall, they were studs, and when you relayed them across, they were joists, and when you put them another way, they were rafters. So I was very confused about some of the terms. You know, it was like, why isn't this just the same thing wherever you put it? But I worked for him for about a year, and by the end of the year, I had a crew of two guys working with me, under me. And he was a wonderful teacher. He was the kind of person who we were doing tongue and groove paneling. And we'd go into a room and the blank wall, he'd say, okay, you do that blank wall, you know, and I'd go along. And when he'd get to a window, he'd go, okay, now come watch how I cut around and what I do to trim out this window. So he really, I was very lucky, and he really taught me to do that. But I never really thought of it as trailblazing at that point. After I stopped, and you should, like I said to you before, I'll talk forever on things, but so you should stop me if after that, actually, I was still living in northern New England, and I knew two other women who had built houses and were doing carpentry, and so we started the Tigris Euphrates Carpentry Company. And it was the three of us, and we did a bunch of renovation work, and it was fascinating because it was just like, you know, women, you know, how women think. We'd come to a problem, we'd be doing this renovation work, and which is, as you know, very different than new construction. It's a lot more figuring out how to make something work. And we'd get to something, and I would like look at something and say, well, we could do it this way, and I'd have like 7 steps. And then Margaret would get to say, well, we could do it this way, and it would be 3 steps. And Martha, who we all have always jokingly said was from Venus, would look at it and say, well, we could do, and she'd have like 20 steps of how you could do it. So we did a lot of teaching each other and figuring out and back and forth. When I became a trailblazer, when I really became aware of that's what I was doing and not just sort of doing my own thing, was getting in 1976 into the United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Joiners of America in Michigan. And I was the first woman to be in any of the trades unions in the state of Michigan. And that was a very interesting story because I had thought about moving to Michigan for a love interest. And I was in Detroit and I called up the district council. And I said to them, hi, I'm a carpenter from New Hampshire and I'd be interested in getting into the union. What do I do? And they said, oh, well, all you have to do is go down to a job site and get a letter of intent to hire and bring it to the union hall. Well, even though I was from New Hampshire where there were not many unions, I knew that the first thing they would ask me on a job site was, where's your card? Before I could get a letter of intent to hire. I mean, even I knew that. So I sort of gave that up. And I was in Michigan for about 4 months at the time, and I was working on the NOW National Conference, which happened to be in Detroit that year. And I was working, making long-distance phone calls around the country from the office of a woman by the name of Edie Van Horn, who was a fairly high up in the UAW. And in the 70s, the UAW controlled Michigan. I mean, it was much more powerful than unions are today. And Edie was an amazing woman. She had worked on the line during the war and had moved through the ranks. And she was everybody's idol. I mean, she was just this wonderful older woman who was just very politically involved in the women's issues and pretty much single-handedly moved UAW to back the ERA and to do a lot of things that were very forward-thinking for the unions. And when I first met her, she said to me, and I told her I was a carpenter, she said to me, you're my idol. And I was like, oh, honey, you're everybody in Detroit's idol. What do you mean I'm your idol? And she said to me, we have been trying to get a woman into the trades unions. We've been trying to break a woman into the trades unions movement. Would you be interested? And I thought about it, and I went home for the summer and decided that, yes, indeed, I would, that it was really an opportunity. And I went back in the fall, and I called Edie up, and I said, okay. And she said, okay, what you need to do is call the district council and tell them that, and I can't think of the guy's name, but the name of the guy who was the secretary treasurer of the building trades in the state of Michigan. So I called the district council and I said, hi, I'm a carpenter from New Hampshire and I'm trying to get into the union. And they said, well, all you have to do, and I said, and so suggested I call. And they said, come right down, pay your initiation fee, we'll give you a card, we'll get you a job. And I was just like, and it was amazing, and it was a $200 initiation fee, and I didn't have the money, and my girlfriend was out of town for the weekend, and I happened to be having lunch with Edie that day, and I went by, and I said, wow, you know, they said I could come down, but I've got to wait till after the weekend so I can get some money, and we had lunch, and Edie, I'll never forget this, she pulled out her wallet and counted out $200, and I said, I can't take this, and she looked at me, and she said to me, if you can't give it to your sisters, who can you give it to? Ooh. And it was just like the most incredible thing I think that's ever happened to me. It was just amazing. So I went down to the district council and got my card and got into the union. And that was the point at which I realized this: I'm doing this not just for myself. I'm doing this for my sisters. I'm doing this for women who come behind me. And let me tell you, it was the most difficult thing I've ever done in my life. It ruined my relationship. It made me totally crazy. And I mean, you know, I mean, it was 1976, it was before there were any regulations. I was on a job of 200, I was the only woman. I knew the guys in my crew, but I didn't know anybody else. There were times that I was scared, physically scared. It was the days when they didn't have tops on porta-johns. And these guys were like off the wall in some of the things they would say to me. But luckily, I drove a 54 Chevy pickup, so I had some respect because of my truck. People really liked Luella, my truck, and that was sort of the only in piece that I had. So it was pretty amazing. So that's a long answer to your question.
Good morning, Jane.
Yeah.
So then you went to California and got your civil service job. How did you do that?
Oh, that was many years later, actually. After Michigan, actually what happened in Michigan, it was really interesting. I worked in the union for about a year and a half. And during that time, I was involved with a group called the Michigan Statewide Task Force on Sexual Harassment. Remember, this was in 77, I think it was. So it was right at the start when women were talking about sexual harassment issues. And I was involved because, again, my girlfriend was involved in the whole women's movement there. And it was very amazing. And I met some women who were from the Michigan Department of Labor Office of Women and Work. They had an Office of Women and Work in the Michigan Department of Labor. And one night, Sandy, who was one of the women from that, called me up and said to me, if you were going to train women to get into the trades, what would you do? And so I just said, you know, I said, what I do is I take all of the excuses I've ever heard of why women can't do it, starting with they don't want to, they're not strong enough, or they don't know anything. And I would answer each of those questions one by one. I do physical conditioning, I teach them how to be assertive because you need to do that on the job, and I teach them some skills. And we talked for about 2.5 hours. And I just thought, wow, this was fun, you know, and I got off the phone and I went, oh, cool. And about 2 months later, Sandy called me up and she said, remember that night that I asked you about this? And I said, yeah. She said, well, I wrote up a proposal and got it funded through CETA. Would you be interested in running the program? And it was very funny because it was being run in Lansing at the community college, which did all the apprenticeship programs at the time. And the Office of Women in Work had said to them, the requirement for the position of director was journey level card and some background in adult ed. And the Office of Women in Work said to them, you'd hire a woman, wouldn't you? And they said, oh, yeah, of course, thinking, well, there are no women with journey level cards. Mm-hmm. And so they handed them my resume. So I did that. That was the start of the Step Up program. And I did that for a year and couldn't stand Michigan anymore. It was too flat. I needed mountains and moved back to New Hampshire. And actually worked had my own contracting company, Sapphis Builders, which was very funny. Because people would say, Sapphis Builders, are you Italian? And I'd go, no. Sappho was a woman from ancient Greece who would teach women things that no one else would teach them. And they would go, oh, well, that's a good name for a women's carpentry company. It was very funny. So I did that, and I did some HUD work, and I had a couple of other women working with me. And then 2 years after that, I went to California. And actually, it was very funny because I worked in San Francisco for a year, just building decks and you know, word of mouth kinds of stuff. Also in Nebraska for 6 months on my way out. And then I moved down to Monterey. And what I had been doing was advertising in the local women's paper, because one of the things I had found was that women love to hire other women, you know, so it was really great. And this was 82, I guess. And I put an ad in the local women's newspaper in Monterey. And about 3 days after the ad comes out, I get a call from the guy who was the director of public works at the Naval Postgraduate School, who had seen my ad. And I was like, why? Why had you seen my ad? Who had seen my ad and called me and said, you know, we'd like to hire a woman. This is affirmative action, and, you know, we'd like to hire a woman. Would you come down and interview? And I went down and interviewed, and they hired me and offered me a job. And it was just like, this is great, you know. It was like, it was just like full-time work all of a sudden, you know. And it was kind of neat, and it was really fun. So I got into civil service carpentry, and I was the highest grade. What was it? It wasn't GS. It was. With civil, oh, you're not
WG.
WG, yeah, wage grade, right? WG. I was the highest WG woman in the public works section, and that was I had a great time.
There were other women, or
there were two women painters and a woman who was learning locksmithing. So there were three other women, but they were all kind of laborer level, and I was journey level. And of course, you know, that had, it definitely had its ups and downs. It was all of a sudden working with a crew of men again, some of whom were wonderful, some of them who were totally supportive, and some of them who were total assholes. There was this one young guy who nobody wanted to work with him, so they stuck him with me, and he refused, and he was an apprentice, and he refused to listen to the things I told him to do. So at one point, I will never forget this, we were doing a job and he refused to do something the way I said to do it. I said, get in the truck and sit there until I'm done. And I drove back to the shop and I went into the foreman and I said, I will not work with him, get him out of my truck. I'm not working with him. And about 3 days later, I heard from a couple of the guys who I was friends with that he had been bad-mouthing me and talking about how, you know, all I just needed was a good fuck. And these two guys, who were both 6 foot tall, this guy was about 5'8", these two guys who were both 6 foot tall took him aside and said, if you ever do anything like this again, you are going to have to deal with us. I mean, it was just amazing. So I had a lot of support. And civil service, this was the military industrial complex. We never carried a ladder that to the second floor. We had a cherry picker. This shop, I'd never seen a shop like this. There were three shapers, every conceivable tool you could ever want. If you needed something, you just go into the tool room. Oh, we'll order it for you, no problem. It was a wonderful experience, and I worked with some guys who were getting ready to retire, and they just showed me tricks that were wonderful. So I really enjoyed it, that, and as I mentioned to you yesterday, you know, you said, well, how could you leave that kind of thing? It was a naval base. It was a naval postgraduate school. Nobody wore uniforms, but it was a naval base. And there was a war room that was five stories down, encased in like a 4 foot thick cement and steel wall, that you were escorted to by an armed naval person in uniform. If you were working with a partner and one of you had to go to get to the truck to get something, they'd have to call another escort to escort you out. So all of that stuff was weird, and it was great. I mean, it was, you know, I got to take sailing lessons on these 24-foot sloops for like $10. You know, I mean, it was all of that, those wonderful perks, and it was also fun because it was maintenance carpentry, which is less heavy.
Right.
Which is, you know, every day you'd go in and they'd have, you know, like three or four chits, and you'd go out and they'd say, you know, some days they'd have like one and they'd say, well, I don't want to see you back here until 4 o'clock. So we'd go down and hang out by the water, by the, you know, the marine labs and like, so parts of it were really, really fun. I really enjoyed it. I really learned a lot. But about 11 months after I started working there, the commandant, we had a new commandant on the postgraduate school, and he put an article in the civilian newspaper that said, I really want to thank those people at Public Works who have made it possible for the military mind to do their job. And I couldn't do it anymore. That was it. It was just like, I fooled myself for like 11 months and I just said, I can't do this work anymore. So I moved back to New Hampshire and did carpentry for a while, and then actually got a call from Vermont. I had applied for some jobs in Vermont and New Hampshire and wanted to really bring Step Up back to New England. And I got a call from the Vermont Department of Education that somebody had put together some funding and was I interested in interviewing for the position of doing some kind of pre-apprenticeship, non-traditional job training. And the interview, literally, when I went into the interview, there were like six people, and the question was, we have X amount of dollars, what kind of training program could you do? Because these people had absolutely no idea of what they were talking about. And I just laid Step Up down to them and they hired me. So that's kind of the progression and of my life.
Yeah. it seemed like you were plugged into the growing tradeswoman movement, like from the very beginning, like all the way from the women in skilled trades in Michigan and the sexual harassment thing before anybody knew what that was, and network construction compliance task force, there's the compliance word early on. And
yeah, well, part of that was the people in Michigan that I was involved with. That I knew. Many of my friends were counselors at community colleges or did adult ed kind of work. So that kind of hooked me into that kind of movement. The other thing that was very clear to me, and I totally didn't tell you about this, but one of the things that happened when I got into the union was I realized I would come home from these horrible days. And the work was, I mean, the work was, it was interesting work because I was a trim carpenter. And we would literally trim out a two-bedroom apartment. You had 4.5 hours to do all the baseboard molding, all the window molding, hang 8 shelves and 2 bifold doors. And then boom, you're on to the next one. I mean, that was, it was production work. I learned a lot of stuff. I learned very good stuff. I mean, mm-hmm. It made me a lot faster. You do that kind of stuff and boom, you're knocking it out. So the work wasn't bad, but just the emotional toll. And I would come home and I would talk to my friends who were guidance counselors. And they would go, or therapists, even worse. And they would go, oh yes, we understand. That must be just, but they had no idea what I was talking about. And I realized that what I needed to talk to other women who had the same experience that I had. And I spent 4 months in Detroit, Michigan, trying to find one other woman who worked in the trades. And it took me 4 months, and I finally uncovered a woman who worked for GM in one of their shops as a tradesperson. And that was literally the start of Women in Skilled Trades in Detroit, because we, and then because of my connections in the adult ed community and in the community college community, we figured out who can we mail out to and try and have a few little meetings. So that was how it started. It didn't start from an activist point of view. It started from a need, a real need for me to be able to say to somebody else and have them really get, and not be a therapist and tell me, oh yes, yes, I understand, but really get, oh yeah, absolutely, those fuckers, can you believe they do? You know what happened to me? You know, I mean, that kind of thing, that kind of empowerment. And that's where that really came from. And I come from an activist kind of background. I grew up Jewish in New York, so that you've got that kind of, you know, that's what you do with your life, that's important.
So your parents were activists?
My grandparents. My grandmother worked with Margaret Sanger doing early birth control stuff.
That's great.
And so that always sort of, you know, she much more skipped my mom's generation, you know, that was kind of neat. So I had that kind of just desire to do that. And I'd gone to hippie colleges where, you know, we did all that kind of stuff. So it was the 60s. I'd gone to college in the 60s. It was everybody was an activist. That was part of what you did.
Yeah.
So, cool t-shirt.
Isn't that great?
Oh, that's great.
Step Up has been really successful. You started in Michigan and Vermont, and now you're gone into the University of New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. How many women do you think you've put into the non-traditional jobs?
What had we figured out? We had figured out in 9 years, and now this is their 10th year, they finish up 10 years now, that we had served probably over 800 women.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah. It's really exciting. And in the state of Vermont, which is a state of 400,000, so 800 women, I mean, you're getting up there and you're, you know, I mean, in New York that may not be a lot, but in Vermont you're talking a lot of the pop, you know. Mm. And I'll never forget, when we first started Step Up, when we tried to expand the funding, the first year was a demonstration program. We had, you know, enough money for one site. And I'll never forget, Department of Employment and Training, who was our major funder through JTBA, said to me, well, don't you think you'll flood the market? With 25 women, and I was like, I don't think so. But I'll never forget them saying that. Don't you think you'll flood the market? I was like, no.
But what do you think some predictors of success are, these women in the program? Like, probably all of them don't.
Some of them have fooled us over the years. I mean, it just like, you know, everything else. I think what, you know, for me, what I really decided was the major predictor was motivation. More than anything else, and I had many arguments with DET, Department of Employment and Training, about they wanted to do a GATB test, you know, they wanted to do all these aptitude tests, and I would always say to them, I have this friend who's one of the best carpenters I know today, builds beautiful stuff, builds beautiful houses, builds wonderful stairs, and many years ago she tried to get into a CETA carpentry training program. She took a GATB test and they said to her, you do not have the math skills to be a carpenter. We will not put you in this program. Mm. And she basically said, fuck you, I'm going to learn to be a carpenter. And she, and it's true, she has the worst math skills in the world. I cannot figure out how she lays out stairs, because she doesn't do it, you know, with formulas the way everybody else does it, or rafters for them. And, you know, she does it.
Yeah.
But she lays out complicated stairs. And I've seen her build wooden spiral staircases. And she has no math skills,
yeah,
but she had the motivation and the determination to do it. So it was always my argument that aptitude, and the other thing that we learned in the Step Up program in Michigan, it was very much a pre-apprenticeship training program. We worked with the unions. Mm-hmm. And back then, as I think they still do today, GATB was one of the major things to get into an apprenticeship program. You had to take that GATB test and score, you know, high in five of the areas. And we found that we could train women and improve their aptitude scores, which to me said these are not aptitude scores. And the one that we did the most was spatial relations. Mm. And I don't know if you remember the GATB test, but what they do for spatial relations is they show you a diagram of basically a cutout with dotted lines of where it would be folded, and they say, if you folded this up, what would it turn out to be?
Yeah.
We taught origami, which is exactly the same thing. You take flat paper, you fold it in certain places, and you come out with different shapes. We taught origami, and in 10 weeks, we raised women's spatial relations aptitude scores by 50%.
Oh, that's excellent.
And it was just like, you can't tell me this is aptitude if we can train people to do this. And the same thing with there was another thing that was a lot of tool recognition, where they'd have a hammer with, you know, part of it colored in, and then they'd have four other hammers and say which is the most alike. And if you recognize this is a hammer and your brain knew that, it was easier to see the differences than if you had no idea what this thing was. Mm. And we're trying to figure it out. So I really think that aptitude, you know, is bullshit when you're talking about this kind of thing, that it's really motivation.
Mm.
And I think for me that was the prime thing that I would look for, was motivation. And that the person had given this thought, that they didn't come and apply to the program and say, well, I really want to be a hairdresser, but this was a program that was available that my worker sent me to. You know, that was the kind of person that was like, well, I don't know, you know. But over the years, we were definitely fooled. I mean, you know, there were people who we accepted into the program, and we thought, this person is the best. And they would, like, totally screw up.
Hmm.
Or there would be, and I'll never forget this, that there was a woman we brought into the program, and we said, I'll never forget this conversation amongst the people who had interviewed her. We said, this woman will never get a job in the trades, but the program will help her in her life.
Mm-hmm.
She was the first graduate to get a job in the trades.
Mm-hmm.
And she stuck with it, and she's still working in the trades. Then this must be 8 years later. And it was just, you know, it's that kind of thing that you do get fooled, but it's... So it's motivation, that's the indicator to me. Then there's other little, you know, like people who grew up with four brothers, they'll probably make it, you know, so there's other kinds of things. One of the things that I've seen that we started doing, on some kind of thing, where there were a bunch of tradeswomen and a bunch of women who weren't tradeswomen. And, you know, I've always tried to figure, okay, what do we all have in common as tradeswomen? Mm. And the one thing that we came up with, because we said to these women, who in this group of tradeswomen were tomboys growing up?
Mm.
And every one of us raised our hands.
Mm.
And I've been doing sort of a non-scientific study of that since then. And I find that that's the one common denominator that I think most of us had, that we were tomboys growing up.
Mm.
So check that out for yourselves as you go around. See if that's true of the tradeswomen you know, because it's my sort of my thesis study.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense.
It does, doesn't it?
So I know for me, periods of my life when I was isolated, Tradeswomen Inc., just the magazine itself, kept me going. And I noticed that you were involved with them. So
I was involved with them when I moved to California.
Oh.
I had been a member of Tradeswomen Inc.
Yeah.
And when I was moving to California, I thought, oh, cool. Here's a support group already there. And it was very interesting because when I moved to California, I moved in. I stayed with some friends in San Francisco, one of whom worked with Equal Rights Advocates, who, as far as I'm concerned, is really the public interest law firm that represents tradeswomen more than anybody else in the country. And this friend of mine, Courtney, worked for Equal Rights Advocates. And Molly Martin was on the board of ERA and was also founder and on the board of Tradeswomen Inc. So I met Molly very early on when I moved to California at an ERA thing. And we became very good friends. And Tradeswomen, that was around the time that Tradeswomen was organizing the first national conference in Oakland.
Did you go to that?
Yes, I did. Absolutely. And that was an amazing experience. Mm. That was an incredible experience to be there. That was the first time that I had really been amongst a group of women. I had met one other tradeswoman who was Journey Level, Carpenter. But at the conference, it was also, I don't know, did you go to that conference?
No, I didn't. Too poor.
It was an amazing, it also really pointed out how different tradeswomen are and how it was very difficult for us to all get along. I mean, it was very clear. There was a lot of very difficult stuff that happened at that conference. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you ever heard about some of
No, I never.
But people got trashed because they invited the wrong person, or, you know, I mean, there was a plenary session that was taken over by a group of radical women, Trotskyites from Seattle. I mean, it was just kind of, it was a crazy kind of thing. But it was also wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Then when I moved to Monterey, I said, okay, who do you have on your mailing list from the Monterey area? And they gave me the name of a woman who's a cabinet maker, who to this day I'm still friends with, who lives in Maine now, actually. And I called her up and I said, I got your name from Tradeswomen.
Well, then there was the National Tradeswoman Conference in Chicago.
Oh, God.
That was my first one. I didn't make it to that. But what was your experience?
Oh, God. Well, let's see. I got involved, let's see, that was 89. I think I got involved with the National Conference Planning Committee in 87. And, you know, I don't really want to give you all the dirt. I don't know what you picked up at that conference, but the National Conference Planning Committee, well, it was a very difficult way to plan a conference. We had no money. We were 15 or 17 women from all across the country trying to plan a national conference together without money. And so people were literally spending their own money to try and get together to meet. And it was some of the most dysfunctional work I've ever done. I mean, we had meetings at one point where we had two people who were literally standing in opposite corners of the ballroom because they were so angry at each other, and we'd sent them to corners so they wouldn't attack each other, literally. I was involved in writing a grant to the Women's Bureau for funding for that, and we got a $50,000 grant from them. It was great, but then this issue came up around the word lesbian, and if that was an issue at the conference. And it was very interesting because the issue came up because we had put in the grant that the conference planning committee would be made up of Journey Level, rural, union, non-union, straight, gay, and we had put straight in there because most of the women involved were lesbians, and we wanted to make sure that there were straight women involved in the planning. I mean, we thought that was important. So that's why we'd even put that in there. And the Women's Bureau people, now remember who this was under. This was in 1989, you know, so it was, you know, the Reagan-Bush era. And the Women's Bureau was under attack, as they are today. And they called and said, we know lesbianism is important. We understand that. What we ask you is not to put the word in things you mail out with our name on it, because it'll red flag it. And so now you have to understand, this was the National Planning Conference Committee was, I would say, 75% lesbians, and you know, who were out, who were very politically active. And we had a long meeting about what do we say to the Women's Bureau, take your $50,000 and we won't have a conference. Or do we say to the Women's Bureau, okay, we won't use the word lesbian. We had lesbian plenaries, we had how to deal with homophobia, we had that stuff at the conference.
Yeah, yeah.
They never said we couldn't do that. They just said, please don't put it in the conference brochure when you mail
right.
it out. And we decided that we wanted to have the conference, we needed their $50,000 to do it. It was the only way we were going to do the conference. And so, yeah, we would abide by their rules. And I know I got trashed at the meeting, at the conference because of that. I got called into the lesbian caucus and, you know, pulled over the coals about how dare we and, you know, all of this kind of stuff. And Roberta McKay, who was a real, is still to this day a very big ally of tradeswomen at the Women's Bureau, got publicly trashed at the closing session. Mm. Publicly trashed about it. And it was very difficult. And out of that conference, as you know, came the National Tradeswomen's Network, which was the second most dysfunctional organization I was ever involved in.
You said that like it's past tense.
Well, the NTN actually is past tense.
Oh no.
I think a lot of it was the same issues of women from around the country. We had some money. Now we had at least had money to get together, but we would come together and we would have such pressing issues to work on that we never spent the time to really build consensus. Was this an organization of organizations, which is how I saw it? Was it a grassroots organization, which is how other women saw it? Who was a tradeswoman? Was I a tradeswoman because I no longer was working with my tools, even though I had been a tradeswoman since the early 70s? And what I kept saying was, if the issues had changed, then I would say, I don't know the issues. But they're the same issues. They haven't changed, so I do know them. Mm. So there was a lot of animosity about who's a tradeswoman. As you may or may not know, the tradeswoman's movement has a history of animosity between tradeswomen and advocates, and who really runs the movement. But when I was told that I was not a tradeswoman, and Lauren Sugarman, who was an elevator constructor for many years, was told that she was not a tradeswoman, and Linda Butler, who was an operating engineer, was told she was not a tradeswoman because we're not currently working with our tools, I got pissed, quite honestly. I mean, you know, there was a lot of hostility and just a lot of shit that went on, and it was very dysfunctional. And you know, people would go to these meetings and we'd get trashed. The last meeting that I ran, we had a facilitated meeting in Miami, and it was horrible. Again, I hate to addition all this stuff, but it was very difficult. Mm-hmm. And I think there was what happened after that meeting, and even the facilitator was like, holy shit, I don't know what to do with this group, you know, because people were just like all over the place. And what we would do was very typical groups. We would start at point A, try to move to point B. Someone would bring in point E. We would jump to point E, never completing A or B, never finish E because someone would bring in C and never accomplish anything. Well, we would finally make decisions, and at the next meeting, people would want to bring them up again. You know, it was just like things that would make me totally crazy. And people just sort of stopped really working on it. And I think what happened was that many of us, it was at a time where a lot of our funding was very kind of, we were worried, you know, my own program, am I going to get my program funded? I don't have time to be working on a network. Mm-hmm. And so it just kind of disintegrated. Mm. And I know at the Tradeswomen's Summit that the Women's Bureau put on, we were trying to pull it together to be very actively involved in that there were a group of grassroots tradeswomen who were going to move forward.
They did a survey.
And they did a survey, and that was kind of the last that I really heard of them. We in New England have been meeting for the past 2.5 years with a group called Northeast Women in Transportation. And it's very different than the NTN in that it's an invitation-only group. Mm. It is not incorporated. It's just it started out being the coup, or actually overthrowing the government with the Janes, and it was Jane Gilbert and her boss Jane Lincoln. So my original files say overthrowing the government with the Janes, and through MDOT, Maine Department of Transportation, they funded us to get together, and we have been doing some national things. A month and a half ago, pulled together women from across the country to come and talk about doing a national strategy. Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, although the NTN in, as itself does not formally exist, I think that there's a lot of work nationally that we're doing.
Yeah.
And that we do have a network that is, you know, a network basically of how do we get information out to everybody. And it's great because Maine DOT has said, you get us the information, we will mail it to everybody on this mailing list. Hmm. And it's more of the feeling that people need to be dealing with their organizations locally, who then will deal, you know, a representative of that organization will then, you know, is the person that we contact and get out an alert or get out whatever, and then it's up to them to get it to their members. So, that's sort of was always my idea of the NTN, I think. But I know people have very different desires and you know, focus of what they wanted that organization to be, and that was one of the issues we never really dealt with, because we were dealing with crises.
Now, the Northern New England Tradeswomen, you started that.
Yes.
And, you know, the conference was wonderful.
Nice, it's the longest running annual tradeswomen's conference in the world.
That's excellent.
It is. It's so exciting. I mean, I love that. You know, it is. Yeah.
Now, is Step Up part of that, or is that something?
It's really interesting. Step Up, the way NNETW happened was that Step Up was funded as a program of Vermont Department of Education, Adult Education. And for the first 3 years, that's how our funding was. And as we wanted to expand, one of the things that we found out is if you are a part of a state agency in Vermont and you bring in other monies, you don't get to keep that money. That money goes into the general fund. And as we began to try and bring in other money to fund Step Up, we found that we couldn't do it. So we realized we had to have a nonprofit organization in order to do that. And that's why Northern New England Tradeswomen was started. I always looked at, I mean, and I think it's true. One of the things that we found, if you look at tradeswomen's organizations around the country, having a training program funded gave us the opportunity to have paid staff who could do, I mean, I always saw my job not as running Step Up specifically, but as being an advocate for tradeswomen in the state of Vermont. And I put that into my grant. There was always a line that said the executive director will act as an advocate for tradeswomen in the state of Vermont, which then gave me the leeway to do what I wanted to do. And so Step Up really was the vehicle out of which Northern New England Tradeswomen came. Mm-hmm. But I think the first annual conference that we did, we were still part of Department of Education.
Hmm.
So.
So the sexual harassment prevention training for non-traditional co-workers, you developed a program for that.
Yes.
That
was actually some of the hardest, after being in the union, that was some of the hardest work I did. We were working, I was harassing a Vermont Agency of Transportation about their lack of women workers and their lack of enforcement of Executive Order 11246 for their contractors. And although it was at a time when there was a state hiring freeze, it was, you know, and so they weren't hiring anybody, but I think I had harassed them enough to get to them to the point of saying, well, we need to do something for when we do hire women. So they decided that, and it was around, you know, when states were really starting to take notice, people were starting to really take notice of sexual harassment. So they decided what they were going to do was they were going to do sexual harassment training for all of their maintenance workers, or as they call them, maintenance workers. They're the maintenance workers. And so they hired me on a consulting basis through NNETW to design the program and to then go to 34 garages, literally. I mean, I was standing in the grease. To do sexual harassment training with the individual crews.
Great.
It was great, and it was very difficult. I mean, I got harassed, you know, as the trainer, it was really very interesting, and it was fascinating. And it was interesting because one of the first things I did in the session was I gave the guys the opportunity to vent about, and through a questionnaire. Why would you feel uncomfortable working with a woman? why would a woman feel uncomfortable working on a crew of men, and gave them the opportunity to, like, rant and rave about what women couldn't do. And then after they got that opportunity, I went through a whole thing about, you know, that literally sexual harassment is violence against women, you know, and just sort of slammed them, but gave them the opportunity to at least get out what they, you know, women are dangerous, they can't do it, I can't talk to them, my wife will... The biggest concern of theirs was that their wives would be jealous. I was amazed at that. I hadn't heard that excuse yet. That was a new excuse. I've heard it a lot since then, but when I first heard it from those guys, it was the new excuse. So it was fun to do it, and it was very, very taxing to do it, really. And I would do two sessions. I'd do a morning session and then an afternoon session with a different crew.
So that piece is ended, or
all the materials. I actually just was asked by a construction company in Maine. They're doing some training in, I think, April, and they asked me if I would be interested in doing sexual harassment training for their workers. Since that time, I have mixed feelings about sexual harassment training. As Jane says over and over again, the boys know that it's wrong. They know it's wrong. But they're perpetrators, you know. I believe that sexual harassment training, that 50% of the men who sexually harass do it just because they don't know how to deal with women. And those 50% get something out of sexual harassment training. I think the 25% who are perpetrators, the only thing you can do with them is fire them. And my feeling now is that I will not do sexual harassment training with a company unless they have a very strong policy that you get caught doing sexual harassment, you're sent home for a day, a week, but you lose money. You get caught a second time, you're gone. And that's my feeling at this point. And because I think just by doing training, it's bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, men know that it's wrong. They know. We don't have to train them not to do it.
Yeah.
So how I look at sexual harassment training has changed.
Yeah. Beyond education into compliance.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's what it is.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so I got that brochure about this thing that's coming up in the fall that looks really wonderful with the Wider Opportunities for Women Net Project.
Oh, right,
implementing the new act, and that you're on the faculty for that. It looks like a wonderful book.
It does. And you know as much about it as I do, because I got the same thing. Literally what happened with that is I got a call from, I think from Kristen Watkins, who said, we're going to be doing, you know, an institute for people, and we'd like you to be on the faculty.
Great.
Are you interested? Yes. Well, we're doing a training. We're going to have all the faculty come together in Washington in the end of May.
Yeah.
And then I got the same brochure. So that's all I know about it. So I can't tell you anything about that. I think it'll be exciting.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think it'll be fun. I hope that there's still affirmative action by then.
Right. Yeah. Affirmative action. I mean, your keynote yesterday was great. Could you talk about, you know, Compliance USA and the Bridge Project and affirmative action?
I left Step Up a year ago. Well, not quite a year ago. And started a Compliance USA, a consulting firm, a for-profit consulting firm. It's really fun to be in the for-profit world, let me tell you, with Linda Butler from Tradeswomen of, they're not Tradeswomen of Purpose, but
yeah, love
Top
that.
Win, yeah. And right now, all of our contracts right now are with the Maine Department of Transportation. And I do several things for MDOT. One is I do their, they do 6 to 8 annual contract compliance reviews of different projects in Maine during the construction season. So for the past 2 years, I've done their compliance reviews. The other contract, the major contract we have with them right now, is on the Portland Bridge Project, which is a 4.5-year, $154 million bridge project. I know in the cities, $154 million doesn't seem like a lot of money, but it's probably 3 years worth of funding from Maine DOT if it was a regular basis. So this is a really big thing for them. And they have two other bridges that are going to be being built in the next couple of years that they're also going to do on-site compliance. It is the first time that a highway or bridge project or any project has had an on-site compliance officer representing the enforcement agency. Maine DOT has also done a lot of work to make to make the project woman friendly. There's near site childcare that is available to anybody who works on the site, men and women, that operates the same hours as the project is working, nights, early mornings, late, whatever you need. There's the on-site compliance. Maine DOT has helped to fund several different training programs to make sure that women and minorities have the basic skills to move into the jobs that are available, including Women Unlimited, which is based is modeled basically on the Step Up program. It's a little bit different, but that they're running a program in Portland and other agencies that do some training. It's really exciting. We're running right now 10% of the hours worked by women. 6% of those are skilled. I don't have all my notes with all the
right.
figures, but I think it was 12% carpenters, 14% truck drivers. Mm. I mean, we're doing really well.
Yeah.
It's not perfect by any stretch of the imagination.
But it's much better,
I think,
right.
than it's been. I think what we've done is we've shown that if people really believe and really want to do this, it can be done. The other exciting piece about it is that my compliance component of it and childcare is being funded, childcare in part, my consulting piece in full, is being funded by construction dollars. Okay? It's not other monies like ICT money or money specifically for women or minorities. This is construction money that is funding child care and compliance, and it's the first time that I think that's happened. So that's also a very exciting piece.
Mm-hmm.
As far as Compliance USA, we named it Compliance USA because we really would like to do work in other areas around the country. With the whole feel what's happening in Washington since November around the attacks on affirmative action, we're, you know, kind of like, well, let's hold off a second before we do a big marketing campaign. So we haven't really done a whole lot of marketing. But I'll tell you, I love the for-profit world. I love doing compliance. There's a power in compliance that you don't have as an advocate. And that's pretty amazing. As somebody from the advocates community, who for years, as I said in the keynote, who for years begged contractors to give me information, I now can say to a contractor, I want this information by 5 o'clock on Tuesday, and their response is, would you like it faxed or FedExed?
I love that.
And I love it. I absolutely love it. And it's been wonderful, and I've been able to, you know, if there's a problem on the site, again, that Port-a-John issue where, you know, one of the women complained to me that she'd been walked in on the Port-a-John, I called the project manager for the prime on that site. I said, this is what happened. I want it fixed by tomorrow. You either get a better lock or you get a new Port-a-John that's for women only. The next morning, there was a new Port-a-John that was for women. And that's really amazing to be able to do that, to be able to advocate for women who are having a problem around pay or have questions about the training they're receiving or whatever, to be able to go into the safety officer and say, here's workables for women's catalog. You should be able to get safety equipment to fit women. Here's a place to get it. And to have them seriously look at it and start ordering. It's really neat to be able to be in that position, to be able to really make some changes.
Mm-hmm.
So I love it.
That's wonderful.
I really love it. And the other thing that's really great is it puts me back in jeans and work boots and a hard hat every day from being more of an administrator.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like that piece too. I that really is who I am.
Mm-hmm.
You know, being an administrator, being a supervisor was never... And by the time I left Northern New England Tradeswoman, I had nine staff people.
Mm-hmm.
And what I found myself doing was supervising instead of doing the actual hands-on kind of stuff. So I'm much happier doing this.
Mm.
It was the right move for me at the time.
That's great.
And the other cool thing about for-profit is that when you write up a budget, at the end of direct costs and indirect costs, profit is a line item. And it's really cool.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's like coming from the nonprofit sector, it's like, wow, you mean I could put profit in at like 10%? Like, yeah,
that's great.
So that's, you know, kind of fun.
So your successes in organizational work have been more locally and regionally, you feel, and nationally there were some problems. Like, so do you have any opinion about Beijing and what tradeswomen could do in Beijing? Or
I think that tradeswomen are, we're a hard group to work with. I mean, that's really my feeling. We're very independent. One of the things that I have realized is that tradeswomen will rarely say thank you. It's really interesting. It was very interesting because when I was interviewing some people who were finishing a training program at the bridge, who were finishing up their training program, and I think there were six women and one Latino man. And at the end of my interview, I said, is there anything else you want me to know? And everybody was like, and the Latino man said to me, I want you to know that your being on this site, I know, changed how I was treated on this site. And I want to thank you for that. Not one of the tradeswomen ever said that to me. And it's something, and I'm not knocking tradeswomen. What I'm saying is that we're very independent, we're tough. We have to be tough. We have to learn to take care of ourselves. And so we're less likely to, like, say thank you, to like, you know how to compromise, because we can't compromise on the job. I mean, I think that kind of, that the situation that we're put in at work on a day-to-day basis makes us be hard to survive. And I think it's very difficult for us, both in our personal lives and our organizational lives, and to let go of that and to come home and be easier. When I was in California, there was a therapist who one of her specialties was working with tradeswomen on how to work through issues in their relationships and be, you know, after being so, you know, so tough at work, kind of how to be tough at work and softer at home.
Yeah.
And because that was really an issue for many women, and I think it is an issue in organizing. I think we have had a lot, don't get me wrong, I think we have had a lot of successes nationally. I think the conferences have been wonderful. Mm-hmm. I think that we have a network of, certainly of organizations, of a way to pass information along. I think that the working session that we had in Portland a month ago, we really did come up with some strategies to work on nationally. I think it was very empowering. So don't get me wrong, I think that we have had successes nationally. And I think it's not an easy thing to do. I'm hoping that the attack on affirmative action is going to make us realize that we clearly have more in common than we have differences, and that's what we and not put aside our differences, because our differences are our strengths,
mm-hmm.
and I think that's true. But I think there are issues. I think there are issues around race. That are very clear that we need to deal with. I think there are issues around gay, straight that we need to deal with in order to make the movement really work. And I think we need to put those issues, we need to acknowledge those issues and then put them aside and be able to work on what are our issues, because I think we do have issues. And that's, you know, that's sort of my hope, is how do we, you know, and we can't have expectations that we'll be perfect around race issues, or that will be perfect around homophobia issues, because we're just people like everyone else. But we need to be aware of them, we need to acknowledge they exist, and then we need to move beyond them. And I think for Beijing, I think all of those things, I think our bottom line, and one of the things we learned through NUIT, Northeast Women in Transportation, is that really works, is if you have a lot of people saying the same thing in the same way, it is really powerful. And a couple of the things that we decided that we would all say, and now we've heard other people saying them back, is that we're not talking, what we're talking about with women in the trades is economic equity. Bottom line, we're talking economic equity for women, number one. And when we're talking to bureaucrats who have jobs to do, and they go, well, what am I supposed to do? You know, I our response is, all we are asking you to do is to do your job. And, you know, we all say that now, and I think that we really learned that if we can have a few, you know, and as much as I hate it, it's that, you know, what, you know, those 30-second sound bites. If we all have, like, the same 30-second sound bites, and we're all saying them all across the country, that all of a sudden people, you're going to start hearing it back from the bureaucrats, and you're going to hear it back. I mean, the commissioner of Maine DOT, I heard him talking about how what we're talking about here is economic equity for women. was like, wow, this works. So I think that's one of the things that we've learned in the Northeast is we need to have the same, you know, everybody calls them bullets now, you know, the same little clips that we're all saying at the same time. And I think that's what works, you know. Affirmative action, we need it. This is how it's worked for me. This is how I've seen my life change. This is why we need it. It's a woman thing. It's a black thing. It's, you know, 90% isn't enough for white males. I mean, it's, you know, all of those kinds of things. We need to be saying the same thing. So that's what I hope to see.
Well, thanks a lot, Ronnie. You want to add anything? You have anything else to add?
This was fun.
Yeah, it was great for me.
Yeah.
Okay.
And now what's happening with this? Come on. She's from NYU. When was it? 1985, 86, 87, somewhere right around there. NYU Law School pulled together a working conference for women, for trans women from around the country to come, and it was a working conference to come and talk about our issues and strategies. And it was the first time that I met many of the women who are very active in the tradeswomen's movement today. Priscilla Golding from Boston, Dale McCormick from Maine, myself, Lisa Deal from West Virginia, I think Lauren Sugarman. I mean, it was in Molly Martin. It was the first time that we were all pulled together. It did not work out as well as we all hoped it would there, because one of the things that happened was that a group of black civil rights people who had worked to get blacks into the trades were there to give us some help. And I think what happened was there was a whole race thing that sort of happened. But I think that NYU conference, although, again, it was a difficult experience for many of us, I was lambasted for being racist by some of the men. Was a really important piece in tradeswomen's history. That it really was one of the first times that many of the women who were isolated in our own areas were brought together to talk about tradeswomen's issues. And Sylvia Law, I think, was the woman who organized that. And so I think that any history of tradeswomen and of the movement needs to have at least a mention of that NYU conference, although I don't look at it with fond memories, quite honestly. But it was one of the first times that we got brought together. The other thing that you asked about early on was the Construction Compliance Task Force network.
Oh, yeah.
And that came about, Wider Opportunities for Women actually pulled that together back in 79 and 80, right after Executive Order 11246 and the apprenticeship regs were passed in 78. Which I actually wrote testimony for. That's how long I've been doing this. Right after that, WOW realized, being in Washington, that WOW realized that OFCCP probably was not doing the job that we hoped they would be doing, I think because Reagan had just gotten elected, actually, so maybe it was 80. And so they called together some women from around the country, mostly from the D.C. area, but there were other women from around the country to come together to be able to share our experiences with enforcement of this regulation. And at that meeting, I met the first other journey-level woman carpenter I had ever met in my life, a woman by the name of Mary Garvin, who I ran into. Yeah, she was from New York. Yeah. And I ran into a friend of hers at another conference last year who said, Mary Garvin saw your name on the agenda and said to just say hello. I haven't seen her probably in 15, probably since that meeting or soon thereafter. But that was one of the most exciting things for me. I'll never forget meeting another woman who was journey level in the carpenters
union. Yeah, because you might be the first two from our generation, sort of.
Well, we may have been. Dale McCormick was also the first woman who went through a registered apprenticeship program.
Yeah.
Through the carpenters. And if you're going to really do a history, you really need to talk to Dale about her experiences getting into the apprenticeship program, because she got in because her first name is Dale.
Yeah.
Because it was a man's name, and they thought it was for a man. And when she showed up, actually, and she had a male friend who returned the application for her, and so when they accepted her and she showed up, they were like, who are you?
Yeah.
I'm Dale.
Right, and they said, no, you're not. We met Dale. And she was like, oh, no. And she pulled out her license. I'm Dale McCormick. You accepted me. I'm here, you know. I don't think any tradesman's history would be complete without that little story, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good story. So
great.
So I think those are the two other pieces of tradeswomen's history that we need to have in there. So.
Well, thanks a lot.
Cool.
Thanks again.
Yeah.
I gave a list, which you'll also find in the Model Penal Code is a list, but I think my list is a little more condensed about the kind of situations, this is under B, Act, of the kind of fact pattern you'll see on an exam, particularly lying in wait. There'll be somebody lying in wait, and that's the kind of act that's in substantial preparation. Okay, so all it really is a substantial act, and what Professor Derby said to define substantial act was extremely close to completion. Okay? I'm not going to take time repeating what I've written down here. This case, U.S. versus Menduhano, which is on our text on page 653. I just went to Westlaw and I took out three paragraphs that I thought really showed what the case is about. He chose not to cover this case. He covered Kraft, People versus Kraft. But it's the same thing. This is a very good case, Mandahano. It is in your text. Under C, a traditional defense to attempt is impossibility. However, under the old common law, it was used most frequently. However, in modern law, it's strictly limited. Very rarely available. An example would be a narcotics agent is on the street and he's selling sugar and telling the addict said it's heroin. So the addict comes up and buys the sugar. He's still guilty, even though it was impossible for him to be guilty of the crime because there never was any heroin. He's not guilty of actually purchasing heroin, but he's guilty of attempting because he completed substantial acts towards that were corroborative of his intent to buy heroin. Okay. So the traditional defense would be that it was impossible, but modern jurisdictions will not permit that. Okay, I think that the narcotics agent buying. That's right. An example of impossibility.
But a
modern
jurisdiction wouldn't have found him guilty.
That's no. A modern jurist would find him guilty.
Would find him. Just as the NBC would.
That's right. Model Penal Code I wrote here, it's written here, 5.01 sub 1 sub A. It's the same under the Model Penal Code. But okay, all of these things are impossible to complete, but modern jurisdictions won't permit it. Now, as far, I don't know beyond this, I personally don't know the answer as to an example of where a modern court would accept the possibility of a defense. I don't think you need to know it for the exam. I think that this is enough to know for the exam. Okay, I do encourage, again, everybody to be critical of what I'm telling you and what I put in these outlines because I'm not perfect. I'm trying to do the best, okay? And when you're critical, that's really, you know, when you're thinking like a lawyer. Another traditional defense, again, we're getting into defenses now, is abandonment. Okay, now the main element is that it has to be voluntary. The Model Penal Code says complete and voluntary renunciation of criminal purpose. Okay. And Professor Derby brought up the same example where the victim dissuades the defendant from committing the crime. That's not good enough for abandonment. The defendant really has to abandon the crime on his own, voluntarily. Okay, another example of where abandonment would not be good enough is if he abandoned it because he figured there's a pretty good risk of getting caught. Okay. Any questions regarding attempt or anything that Professor Derby talked about attempt this evening? Okay. The next two pages, there's two pages to hand out six, is a list of defenses with elements. This is what we have coming up. These defenses are very similar to the defenses in tort law, some of them. So for instance, self-defense or defense of others, I think it's virtually identical. You know, you have a right to defend yourself or a third person against the use of unlawful force. And the rule in tort law is that you're to use like force. So if somebody's going to punch you, you can punch them back, but you can't shoot them. If somebody's going to shoot you, then you can shoot them to defend yourself. These elements are pretty explicit, I think. Okay, one thing on number A4. If the defendant was the aggressor, self-defense is not available. Unless he came up and was going to punch the guy, and then the guy drew a gun, and then like I said, he was a non-deadly aggressor confronted with the unexpected use of deadly force. Or if he withdrew after his initial aggression and his intended victim continued. Okay. I think that's still straightforward. Okay, as far as retreat, different jurisdictions have opposing rules. I think that what Professor Derby endorses is that if the defendant was in a position to retreat, he has to retreat unless he was in his home. Okay, so if someone comes up to you with a knife and you have an opportunity to run away and you didn't, self-defense will not be available to you as a defense. Okay. Unless you were in your home, then you have a right to protect yourself in your home. I think it has to be your own dwelling. Your own dwelling. Is the language that it's used in the model. It has to be your own dwelling. Okay, it's the same rules for defense of third persons. It's just like defending yourself. I thought that this case, State versus Hodges, was relevant because that's the kind of example Professor Derby might come up with, the battered women's syndrome. Where the wife is beaten by the husband and he beats her and beats her and finally she lashes out and kills him. And that, this is a real life situation. And that's where self-defense is going to be raised. Okay. Defense of property, I think, is straightforward. It's similar to tort law. Okay, you can defend your real and personal property only with a reasonable degree of non-deadly force. It's never reasonable to kill somebody to defend your property or when you say deadly force, you're including force that could be deadly. It doesn't have to result in death.
What is Dr. Dog?
Well, your dog is a property.
I know.
Personal property. Your dog can kill the person. And if he hasn't hit anybody before, you get off. Okay, law enforcement, a police officer. These are all defenses. These are affirmative defenses that the defendant will raise and have to prove, has the burden of proof. All of these are defenses. Police officer in the performance of his duty and has a probable cause, he's chasing a defendant or a suspect, and the guy shoots at him, and he shoots back, and he kills him. Somebody else, you know, might raise self-defense, but all the officer has to do is raise the defense of law enforcement. He's privileged to do that, and that will be a complete defense. Okay, D is domestic authority. Okay, that's parents and teachers, okay? In New York State, teachers may not touch students, but in many state jurisdictions they can. Parents always have the right to use force against reasonable force on their children. Yes?
The law enforcement, is that on or off duty?
A police officer is always a police officer. If he's engaged in law enforcement, whether on or off duty, in fact, a citizen can be engaged in law enforcement. You could be happening by a bank, you happen to have your licensed pistol, you see there's a lone robber, you walk in behind, you point it to a head, drop the gun, drop the money, and call the police, everybody. You're acting in a law enforcement capacity. Now he turns. Okay. He's got a knife in his hand, you shoot him in the head. You've got a defense of law enforcement.
Let's
back up. When you speak about the law, it's very important to remember not to use pronouns, or like in court or something, because it's hard to know who he is. Okay, the guy who was being held up did what?
He pulled his gun and killed the two perpetrators.
Yeah, just like Bernard Goetz.
Yeah, exactly.
But this is, I guess, the difference. Goetz thought it was coming. He didn't know it was coming.
Yeah.
He assumed these guys actually pulled a gun, which turned out to not be a gun, like a pellet gun, I think.
Right.
But remember.
Well, you would have the defense of self-defense.
Self-defense.
Even if it's a BB gun,
it's subjective. If the victim reasonably believed there was a gun, then he's got self-defense and he can use deadly force.
It has
to be imminent danger. That's absolutely right.
They don't have to retreat.
Oh no, not if you're an imminent danger. You have to. If you had the ability to retreat, according to Professor Derby, you had to retreat. Now somebody's point-blank range at you with what you believe to be a weapon, I don't think that it would be reasonable to say that you had the retreat available. Duress is there's elements that I've listed, four elements, and that's the situation where someone takes your child hostage and says, look, you've got to go to work where you work at the bank, and you've got to set up something on the computer so I can break in at night and transfer funds, or your kid's history. And that's a defense. In other words, so then the guy goes into the bank and he sets it all up and he does the transfer of funds just like he's told. He was under duress. There was a threat by a third person, which produced a reasonable fear in the defendant that he, okay, in this one it's he will suffer immediate or imminent death or serious bodily injury. I think that could be applied to a third person as well, as in my example. Okay. Okay, and that defense, as I noted, is generally not available for homicide under statute except felony murder, but may be considered in reduction of the crime. Okay, necessity. That's basically the harm sought to be avoided is greater than the harm committed. An example. Which was? Oh, right. Where the sailors eat the kid. Okay, that was. You're absolutely right. We could go back to that. Thank you. Did the defendants choose the lesser of two evils? The court said no. If we go through the analysis, was the harm sought to be avoided greater than the harm committed? Well, that's the big question. And the court decided no, but in the defendant's minds, they were trying to say, their argument was that either we all die or one of us die. Better that one of us die than we all die. Okay, and the court didn't buy into that, because even though if they brought that factually, legally it would have been a sufficient argument, but they didn't believe it factually. The court felt that there was no guarantee that they would all die. They didn't know that for sure. Okay, there also has to be no alternative, or, you know, or a less serious alternative, like me chopping off his toes for a snack, I don't know.
Oh, God.
Okay, the harm has to be imminent. You know, like these guys were really getting ill and they're gonna die soon. And it has to be not caused by the defendant, the situation. We're really ripping through these defenses. It's the only way that I know to cover all the material before the end of the semester. If you go through this, and then he talks about the defenses and loops through all the problems and this loopholes, if you stick with this outline, you'll be in good shape, and it'll give you a basis on which to ask questions that make sense, okay, to get him to stick to the plan. Okay. Consent and condemnation. Okay. For instance, I said here, consent does not bar criminal lack of liability unless lack of consent is an element of the crime. Okay. Consent. An example of consent not barring criminal liability is, at least for the present time, you help me commit suicide. Okay? Maybe I shouldn't say that. I want you to kill me because I don't have the guts to commit suicide. Okay? Now, the person would still be guilty of murder because consent would not be available as a defense. Okay, an example where lack of consent is an element of the crime would be rape. Okay, so that if you're convicted of rape, consent, or charged with rape, consent would be a complete defense if it was proven. Okay, again, these are affirmative defenses, all of them, which the defendant has the burden of proof. Okay, just to give you an idea of criminal procedure in the trial, first the prosecutor has to make out his complete case. Then the defense counsel will probably make a motion to dismiss the indictment or the charges and say that the prosecutor has not made out a case. At that point, the judge will probably say the prosecutor has made out a case. That's when the defendant puts up his affirmative defenses and has to prove them. And also cross-examine on the prosecutor's case. Okay, entrapment. Now, I went into this because it's something I'm interested in, and I gave the majority rule and the minority rule. He didn't test on this, and I don't know if he'll even spend time on it in class with you. Okay, so I'm not going to spend time now, but I have these rules written out. It's really a but-for test. But-for the police action, the defendant wouldn't have committed the crime. The way that it works out in New York is that they talk about it in different terms. In New York, they're concerned with whether the defendant was inclined to commit that crime anyway. Okay, so now let's say you have an undercover narcotics agent, and he goes up to the drug dealer, or who he thinks is a drug dealer, sell me some drugs. The guy doesn't know him, and he's a little leery, he says, no, go away. Then the cop comes back, sell me some drugs, he'd go away. If you don't sell me some drugs, you're really going to be in deep shit. I'm going to blow up your house, I'm going to do a... Okay, take the drugs, here you go. Now he's been entrapped. Okay, under this, under the majority rule, entrapment would not be available to him, or would be available to him, In New York, they would say, well, there's evidence that this guy was dealing drugs anyway, so that he was inclined to do this kind of action anyway, so that it's easier for police to entrap defendants in New York. Okay. I'm not going to go on because the Model Penal Code talks about that. Now, next week, I'm going to cover mental disease and defect. Please don't leave. I just want to say one thing about these handouts. Handout 8 is conspiracy. I've gone into it pretty completely. However, he's just going to touch on it. Okay? And you might get an opportunity to talk about it in an exam, but it's not likely. Okay? I've covered it because it's part of the material of the course, but he's not really covering it in depth. I've given extra readings, two pages of handout 9, which I think speak again to fact patterns that he may give on the exam, kind of things that may interest him. Okay, so next week we'll talk about mental disease or defect, which is a really big topic.
Thank you for the handouts.
You've got to address the specifics. So what you're saying is a court should bestow this discretion on trial courts to order exams, and so that, you know, order exams within the discretion, you then go on to say that, you know, exam is appropriate here. Because you, although the function of this court is to create law, it creates law within the framework of individual disputes. And obviously, you have to ask for a remedy that specifically helps your client. But on the basis that there would be a remand, in order to help your client, you have to first have the discretion bestowed on the trial court, and then have acknowledged that it's appropriate to use it here. And you're essentially asking that court to recognize it. Yeah?
You've got these two connected with each other, and yet in the book, the point is supposed to be independent, complete,
right,
and a freestanding ground for a ruling. So if you lose on one, you're not going to get two.
That's not entirely true, because if you look at them, this says that as a general principle, it's within the discretion of trial courts to order exams. So what that the inference there being that it's failure to order an exam below, you know, resulted in your client being deprived of due process right. Given a general, given the principle, exams should be at the discretion of the trial court, in this particular instance, it's appropriate.
Let's say they say it's not within the discretion of the trial court.
Then, it doesn't matter because you're not asking the trial court, now you're just saying to this court that it's appropriate to compel an order in this instance. This looks to create a rule, but this looks to answer the specific problem that your client has.
I just get the feeling that the first one is saying, well, they have the discretion to do it, but the second one is saying, if you decide that we're not supposed to do it, if the trial court shouldn't do it at all, here's the exception.
No, I don't think it's doing that. No, I don't think it is doing that. Because what you're doing first of all here is you are making an argument based on obviously on precedent that looking at other jurisdictions, it's within the discretion of the trial court to order these kinds of exams. And what that then leads into is, well, in what kinds of situations is it appropriate to order these kinds of things?
Just in some grounds, and I don't see it, is that if you don't get one, I don't see how you get two. If they say the court doesn't have the discretion
but you don't actually, okay, I think, all right, yeah, I'm sorry, maybe I misunderstood your question, and I think it's all clear now. Go back a step. Now, the argument that your appellate brief represents is a single argument. It may contain completely separate theories for me, so that you may have a claim in a contract claim in court et cetera, et cetera.
I know what you're saying, but that's not what it says.
And that's what it should be free, it should stay on their own. Each court should stand to be self, to be a part.
And they are, I think.
I think what he's saying is, if this court does not allow the trial court's discretion in ordering it, how can they then order it in this case? And you're saying, even though they may not give the discretion to the trial court, this is the Supreme Court, or whatever court we're in, and that they have the authority to.
No, all right, and then let me go back, because I wasn't clear about the House's question, but I think I understand. When you construct an appellate brief, you have an argument. It then has these discrete parts. But these parts are not, they're not necessarily absolutely independent of each other. So that when you construct your argument, you are really constructing, you know, one whole argument. When, for example, you have the potential for relief, you know, contracts and the torts, it still arises out of the same event. So that there is a level on which, whilst they are discrete arguments, they are related arguments. Now, what the appellant's argument does here in terms of construction is it says, in general terms, it's within the discretion of the trial court to order exams. And then it says, you know, ordering an exam here is appropriate. So that these are related. It isn't like an indictment where a court would rule on one and the other separately. The court rules on the argument as a whole. And the argument as a whole is an appeal which asks the question whether a non-consenting complaining witness can be compelled to undergo a medical exam. And so the court looks to answer that question. Now, to the extent that it answers the question narrowly, only in respect of this problem, then it creates a precedent that's pretty hard to apply, as you would have seen has been created in several jurisdictions by different courts applying different sets of rules, different tests. If it answers the question, you know, more broadly, then, you know, it adopts the argument as a whole and creates a much clearer standard for subsequent cases. But they are related to each other. And it's just a case of, but don't think of them as being absolutely, don't think of them as being capable of existing separately as separate briefs. Because they're related, they are separate parts of the same argument. A general right and a specific remedy. Here, Ms. Shams.
Isn't it also addressing the issue in two different ways? For instance, the second point heading, you're also going to say that it is within the court's discretion to order events, in addition to explaining why it's opposed to this one thing to be the second thing to be in this
case. I see. Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's true.
Isn't that conclusion? I mean, that's the conclusion that it's within the discretion that has an answer.
Well, that's the point of writing the appellate brief, is that you tell them that they can do this, then you sit back and hold your breath to see if they do. Remember I told you I went to a U.S. Supreme Court argument last semester? Did I tell you about that? Oh, well, we just got the results today. We lost 9-0. So, there's where the court said. I just proved it was never going to work because it's going to cost the government oodles of money. This order should be granted. You know, it's appropriate to do this. You say that, then you sit back, you hold your breath, and you wait for them to buy it. or to reject it. Let's pause for a second, let's look at the appellee argument, and then let's see if it seems to sit better with you when we look at the subheadings. What is the appellee's argument going to be? That's right.
The trial court has absolutely no authority to expand the criminal defendant's discovery beyond what the state has.
They have
no
right to
They can't order it.
They can't order it.
They have a yes or no authority.
They can't order the exam.
That's right.
I got it.
Thank you. No. No.
Exactly. No.
Trial court should not. Right. That they basically shouldn't be able to order these exams.
Well, that's
we don't want
your
discretion.
I
know the answer is negative. Okay.
Trial court was correcting its decision.
Right.
Correcting not ordering the exam.
You know, affirm because there's an instance where you might want to tack on that that sort of underlying layer of an appellee's position because it enables you to couch your argument more affirmatively. I mean, obviously, there are certain instances where you can't avoid a negative. I mean, you can, let's see. You could say something like, trial courts lack the discretion to. I mean, that's still a negative, but it's like a wishy-washy.
It should be trial courts should affirm.
No.
Negative then.
It's just right. A wishy-washy. What's that?
It should be trial courts should affirm because.
No.
It's like trial courts should not, you know, be able to compel these things. Or you could just say, you know, this was to accommodate your not liking not. So, you know, they should affirm because.
Right, that's what I'm saying. That's sort of not really.
Isn't that issue number one addressing number two on the appellate side? Isn't it closer to number two?
No, why? Because here, this is the mirror here. You're saying ordering exams is within the discretion of the trial court, and here you're saying it's not within the discretion of the trial court. I mean, it's just the way we've written it up. We could have written it up that
no, you
say,
no, what you're saying there is they shouldn't affirm this motion for a new exam. You're not saying it's not within their discretion.
What?
No,
that's what I thought you said.
No, but that's not what you said. You said the trial court should not, what, affirm this motion?
Oh, no. Trial courts should not order. This was an alternative to frame a more positive.
Sorry.
Yeah, to confuse the issue totally. You could say, trial courts lack the discretion.
Okay.
You know, I mean, I'm not intending to actually write these for you so much as identify what should be contained in them. So here they are mirrors of each other. That on the one hand, appellant says, you know, you can and should bestow this discretion on trial courts to order exams, and appellee is saying, absolutely not. You know, trial courts should not. You know, they lack the discretion to do that. You know, they shouldn't be permitted to order gynecological exams, whatever. What's your argument here? Just that went from, you know, we should bestow them, and in particularly, in bestowing this discretion, you know, exercise it absolutely in this kind of case.
Or you could just put the appellant has no right to attempt to compel. They don't have a good argument for trying to compel, or
no, you're looking, this is general, and you're looking now to go specific. But we've said that they don't even have the discretion. So what do we need to do just to frame it, Mr. Ackerman?
Well,
if they did have the discretion, they properly used it? They probably...
No, start it again.
If they do have the discretion, in this case...
Absolutely, yes, exactly. It's the old even if argument. You know, it's like, well, look, even if you do have this discretion, shouldn't exercise it here. It's not appropriate here. So it's the old even if, not here.
Is it true?
Yeah.
On this side, each stands separately on its own. In that, even if you lose on one, you can still win on your separate rulings. In that, let's say the first one, they say, you're wrong, trial court should have the discretion. And the second one says, well, even if you rule that they do have the discretion, this is not the appropriate choice to do it.
But those are merely, those are arguments in the alternative, and those are related arguments, but each time they merely represent the argument to the court for a general proposition to order, not to order, and then look to the applicability of this particular circumstance.
I think what Steve was trying to say is that he might be more comfortable if it's number one, if you talk about discretion, it says that the defendant has a general right to discover the material in the possession of the state, including compelling a second exam. And then number two is saying, in this case, if it's not an absolute right, it should be within the discretion of the court, and we can compel it to court.
That's
right.
That's exactly what I was saying.
Fine.
Well,
are you opposed?
No.
No, but that's the only way that it makes sense of these to
I'm
be
trying to make you feel better.
No, but it's the only way, if they're supposed to be independent freestanding grounds for a ruling, these two are related, and they don't
yeah,
seem independent.
But it's still, I think you're missing a point, just because what I'm trying to do here is identify for you what you should, just in general terms, have in this point, and that you frame them. I mean, I do not want to see this reproduced on.
Oh,
I have a last submission. You know how you come to frame them. It's just that this is the general that you know exams, independent exams are a good thing, especially here. Independent exams are a bad thing, even if they're not. They don't belong here.
It's not that they're a bad thing. They don't belong at all. And even if they belong, then definitely not here.
Well, you get, I mean, I'm trying to talk now in the most general terms. Good thing, bad thing, especially here, even if not here. I mean, just in general terms. What do you envisage putting into your point heading? Point headings is used to describe all of the headings, both main headings, which are sometimes also interchangeably called point headings, but then subheadings. What are your subheadings? First of all, you're saying here it's a good thing. How?
What?
Why? Right. Why is it a good thing? Or when is it, when in general terms, when in general terms is it a good thing? What in general terms makes ordering exams terribly important? What do those exams have to do in order for them to be, you know, terribly
order information that would help the defendant.
They have to be
materially assisted.
Right. So you're something you mean something like, you know, if of material assistance. I mean that's gonna be one of them. So you're going to look to say in general terms, if exams are a good thing, then in particular, what makes them a good thing or when do they particularly assist in, you know, the process of justice? Well, where they satisfy some standard that the court says, you know, material assistance, or some other standard. I mean, we've seen other standards. If you want to look there at some other standard. Now, if you're saying ordering them is a bad thing, what are your subheadings going to do? Right, okay, now well, you're sort of suggesting several things here. You're suggesting privacy, you're suggesting, you know, not necessary, you're essentially saying not necessary because there are other tools to determine the same information, like cross-examination. Okay, yeah. What else?
Physical and emotional trauma.
Which of those do you think you're going to put in under this, you know, orders are a bad thing? Yeah, I think you could probably work the privacy one. I don't think you can work the right of discovery. I think what you can do is work a sort of, you can work at other means as an argument.
What about the subject of seizures? That shouldn't be else. It's all in there.
And also you could look to other kinds of exams. No, look to analogize to other types of exams.
Yeah.
So is it that all orders compelling, are a bad thing? Right. So, you know, compare to psychological, rectal, whatever. I mean, and that's all in there. Now, what this is your subheading under, not only is a good thing, but especially here, what sort of subheadings would you have here? Mr. Reynolds, any ideas? What kinds of subheadings would you have under appropriate here? So specific. Not only are exams a good thing, but they're a really good idea. You know, in terms of, you're trying to construct an argument that gets relief for your client.
A due process.
Okay. All of those look to the underlying. The underlying constitutional issue. I'm just musing here. If you're saying the exam is appropriate here, what have you got to do to get the court to buy it?
Lefebvre.
Right. Okay, and so, okay, if you say it was inadequate, how, are you just picking a standard out of the air? Where are you getting your standard of adequacy from?
From the kind of document.
No, I don't think, well, I mean, that's certainly an issue, but what you're really getting at, if you're looking to justify why it's particularly appropriate here, then you've got to show the court how it can do that. Yeah, that's right.
Argue that the first examination failed to prove.
Right. I mean, you can do that. What I'm trying to get at here, and you're identifying at least on a factual level what you need to be doing, but you're not necessarily pinpointing the legal argument that accompanies the factual.
Identify exculpatory evidence that is overlooked by the purchaser. Show where your compelling need is.
Yeah, you want to get into your particular, you have to show how applying particular standards is appropriate. So look to see what are your existing standards and show how, that if you used, say, material assistance as standard, then you would absolutely have to have an examiner's assistance. Because if you used material assistance that would mandate an exam, then then look at your other standard. Or if you use this standard, and what you need to do is show the court. Courts need rules. So a court needs to have a legal framework. And I think you're doing the right thing in saying that it's the inadequacy of the other exam that is somehow depriving him of the due process right. But you have to have a legal framework for that argument. Mr. Rahm.
Well, legal right to rebut expert, the man is liable to be convicted on expert testimony, and he has he needs the opportunity to be able to rebut that expert on equal ground.
Not in a criminal trial.
Not in a criminal trial?
No. He can cross-examine, but not necessarily in a criminal trial. What you want to be doing here is looking at your various standards and show how then it's particularly appropriate here. And what you'd want to be doing here is, if you're doing my argument is orders are a bad thing. Even if they're not a bad thing, or even if they're, you certainly always say they're, even if they're a good thing, but even if they're not an altogether bad thing, it's not appropriate here. How do you demonstrate it's not appropriate here? Yeah.
Is it the circumstances, the time frame that's allowed? Is that the emotional trauma bringing all that stuff?
But you're coming back to the facts again. What's the legal argument? Yes, those are the applicable facts, but what's the legal argument of why, even if order's not entirely a bad thing, we certainly don't belong here? What do you need to show? You're looking to do what? You're looking to affirm. You're looking to make sure the decision below is not disturbed. So what have you got to do here?
That the evidence gleaned from the examination would not be of material assistance.
Coming back to the facts, what is the legal argument for why, even if orders are not necessarily a bad thing, absolutely not in this situation? How do you show that? How can you show that? Yes, because what you're going to do then is you're going to say, no matter which standard we apply here, and we have plenty to pick from, we can show that no matter which standard we applied, it would not alter the outcome. Exactly. Good. That's the legal part of the argument. Because your argument needs both a legal framework, and a factual framework. So what you're pointing to is how you show that your case is similar or different to another case. But what you need is the legal framework within which to work, which means going through, you know, the standards and showing the outcome according to which side you're on. Okay, so, you know, outcome would be all yes on that side, and outcome would be all no on that side.
The standards are coming from where? Other case law?
Other case law. Because that's all you have. There's no precedent in the Supreme Court, and there's no precedent in UConcha. The United States Supreme Court has not ruled on this issue, and so all you have is the other cases. Okay?
Sure you don't
want to
go another hour
and talk about it? No. How is that more than one subject?
Because you got more than one idea. Let's come back to that in 1 second. All right, let's just ask a couple of things because we're really running out of time. Unjust enrichment. If every time the courts looked at the sole asset, sole asset, sole asset, and that's been really quite determinative of the whole unjust enrichment question, what's the answer to unjust enrichment in Olga's case? If the Geographical Society gets to keep the diary, is it being unjustly enriched by keeping it? Ms. Chambers, what do you think?
Well, I think if it were a donation, no, they're not.
Well, let's forget the nature of it, but if they, however they acquired it, if they keep it, which is the bottom line in these kinds of cases. If they keep it, are they being unjustly enriched by keeping it? Who thinks yes? Just show of hands.
Oh.
Who thinks no? I'll go with the no's, actually, I think.
Doesn't it have to do with the nature of the society? You know, like if there's a society that puts stuff on display and charges a fee for people to see it.
Big question in your memo is going to be, you know, does the Geographical Society have any intention of realizing the asset? You know, are they going to turn around and sell it?
No.
They don't have to sell it.
No.
Right.
The mere possession could be a benefit for them. Yeah. They don't have to sell it.
But they're a society. Now, it does...
What? Is that considered
if they're a charitable organization, can they... Can anything that they have constitute an unjust enrichment?
Yes. Does a museum have to sell something in order to be benefited by it?
Actually, and there's an interesting point. I was listening to public radio yesterday, and they were saying that when museums sell things, they don't actually call it a sale, they call it a deacquisition. So as not to offend the people who donate, they call it a deacquisition. Isn't that great? Let me talk about the problem. The point is, there isn't a clear answer to this. I think that she can definitely recover. No, you're not. You're off. The no, she definitely can't recover. Closer to the right answer. I think that may take the day, just because we really don't know. But what you do is you go through the analysis and you come out. If I had to make a decision, I'd say no. That's just my opinion. I think she doesn't have a shot at it. But I think for Mr. Ferrello, we had the makings of a very good idea. What if you're Olga's lawyer, and you're meeting with the lawyers for the Geographical Society, what might you suggest to them?
Well, if they just take the measurements, then they could very well keep the diary, because that's what she really wanted them to do.
Right.
Not give it back, and then they wouldn't be unjustly enriched, and everything, you know, that goes along with it.
They did what she wanted, and
that's it. They keep the diary. There was no words to her to, after they did the measurements, for them to give it back.
Right. I mean, wouldn't you actually sit down with the other attorney and say, look, you know, how much is it going to cost you time and money to do this study?
You get to
keep the diary, because all she wants is the results of the study.
That's a really practical
solution to a difficult problem. And it's a practical solution because this doesn't have any easy answers.
But you're a lawyer, you wouldn't want to do that. I mean, that's giving them an out.
Well, no, the question is, as her lawyer, no, I'm not suggesting you should do that if it flies in the face of her wishes.
Their lawyer may suggest that.
Well, their lawyer may suggest it, but what I'm saying is, you sit Olga down and you say, Olga, what do you really want? What are your litigation goals here? what, you know, what do you really want? And if you can't have what you really want, what are you willing to settle for in terms of, you know, what we can achieve here? I don't think that she has much of a chance of getting the diary back based on the nature of the transfer, but I would certainly then, so my next line of offense would be to say, but I bet we can get them to do the study for you. You know, and if you, you know, given that I don't think you can get the diary back, how do you feel about the study?
Yeah, that's, well,
that's what she wanted. If, you know, if there's some study and it makes, you know, the front page of the science section of the Times.
So that other people can come along and do the same thing that Sloan did.
Can't say, right.
Right. It would confirm, that, you know, 100 years ago, this person went closer to the pole, you know, than anyone else managed to do for almost a century later.
So this one fact you have to take into consideration is the fact that the society of Nambour actually refused to do that, to do the study. The letter that they, were replied to this in the letter,
the
order stated that when the board of directors chooses to do it, we will do it. I mean, it's not a refusal, but
it isn't a refusal, but what kind of a letter is that that's coming back? Who do you think wrote this letter? The lawyers for the society, who used very careful words like donation, no promise, orally or in writing. Yeah, this was the lawyer's response at the point when she was saying, hey, you know, nothing's happening here. No, they haven't said absolutely they won't do the study, and that's why I think if you asked Olga what she wanted, one of your best shots is to try to get them to agree to this. You know, at this point, because then it seems that's going to be, you know, the closest way to get everyone happy. If you as a lawyer felt that you could show constructive trust, I'm not suggesting for a minute you would compromise on that, but I'm saying that on the law, I think you'd have a pretty hard time with this one, you know, to actually go that distance. Yeah, Mr. Morrell. Whatever conclusion you come to in a legal memorandum, it's the analysis that counts. So long as you can support your conclusion, there are rarely right and wrong answers. So whilst I'm saying that personally, I don't think she can get this on the constructive trust, if you can make an argument on an interpretation of the case that supports it, it's the analysis that's important. We will never agree on the outcome. I can't imagine there's ever going to be a case where if I spread for a show of hands, we would all agree on the outcome. The point is, it's the analysis that counts. And whether you disagree with me or you agree with me, that doesn't matter and that doesn't affect when I'm looking at something. I think in just having a little more experience on the law than you do, and in talking with my other colleague who's also using this problem, the balance of the more experienced lawyers looks like no. All right? But that's not, you know, it's not an absolute answer. Mr. Ferrello's suggestion that maybe we can, you know, figure something out on a practical level is an enormously sensible and appropriate response to this problem. Given that we can't do for our client what we might want to do for her, you know, we at least want to do something that's going to make her happy. All right, and that's very possibly within our power. Okay, what I want you to do is have a look at the problem. We'll talk about it Tuesday. As for the reading that you're preparing for next week, for the first set of reading, the pages 77 to 86, just do exercises 2 and 3. Okay, skip 1. And then for